Now, U.S. officials and others are concerned about potential war crimes being committed by Russia in its war on Ukraine. On Friday, Vice President Kamala Harris called on the International Criminal Court to investigate whether Putin has violated international law in his attacks in Ukraine.
Absolutely, there should be an investigation, and we should all be watching. And I have no question the eyes of the world are on this war and what Russia has done in terms of this aggression and these atrocities.
Vice President Harris pointed to video footage that came out late last week appearing to show a Ukrainian maternity hospital struck by a Russian missile. Prosecuting war crimes isn't as simple as gathering footage from the war zone, and the U.S. is in a complicated position with Russia and the International Criminal Court. Our guests today are experts on war crimes, international law, and political behavior. They're here with us to help us better understand what could happen with Russia and Putin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about war crimes? Do you want to see Putin prosecuted for his attacks in Ukraine? What kind of punishment do you think would be appropriate? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jessica Wolfendale is a professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at Marquette University. She's co-author of the book War Crimes, Causes, Excuses, and Blame. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Mark Berlin is an assistant professor of political science, also at Marquette University. He's author of the book Criminalizing Atrocity, The Global Spread of Criminal Laws Against International Crime. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jessica, let's start with you. Can you talk about the reason that some of the international community came together and tried to say some of these actions during wartime constitute crimes above and beyond the usual things we might see in war?
That's actually quite an interesting question that you end talking about what we normally see in war, because it might seem strange to think that, you know, given that war already involves killing and destruction, some people might already think war is essentially involved in crime, mm-hmm. given that it involves killing and destruction. How do we distinguish between killing and destruction that's permissible in war and killing and destruction that's not permissible in war? So one way to think about the origins of the laws of armed conflict is both coming from a position of recognizing that individuals have fundamental rights that shouldn't be violated even in a context of war, like rights don't magically disappear. And so people who are not engaged in a conflict, such as civilians, have moral rights against being harmed in the course of a conflict. So that's one angle which gives rise to certain kinds of important protections that civilians have under the laws of armed conflict. Another reason, and I think this is also something which can sometimes be hard to reconcile with very aggressive wars like the one we're seeing now, is that maybe part of the goal here is to try and minimize the destruction caused by war. And one way of doing that is saying, look, okay, we recognize that war is always, you know, in essence, destructive, but by imposing constraints that both sides of a conflict are bound to recognize, that at least puts some constraints on the scale and targets of the destruction. So that's a sort of another way of thinking about the purpose of war crimes that really comes from what you might call a pragmatic approach, and combining that with what you might call a sort of moral approach, which says that, again, there are individuals in war who have a moral right not to be harmed. And so we ought to do as much as we can to protect such individuals. But again, there's some, you know, again, it's still a strange situation because, you know, traditionally the way the law has viewed conflict is that soldiers on both sides of a conflict, so even soldiers who are fighting on the manifestly, obviously aggressive, unjust side of a conflict, they actually have the same legal protections as soldiers fighting on the side of justice. So they have, for example, prisoner of war protections. If they surrender, they have to be treated in accordance with the Geneva Conventions. They can't be, for example, put on trial just for fighting in a war. And that seems a little bit strange if you think about something like the situation we're looking at now, where we have one side engaged in, again, a manifestly, very clearly illegal and aggressive war. And so to then say, well, soldiers in that war can somehow still engage in permissible acts seems odd.
Mark, can you talk about the challenges of enforcement? Because in a lot of ways, someone's only going to be charged with the war crime, successfully charged and prosecuted, if they lose the war. If they win, nobody can really enforce that on them. Is that kind of a core problem here?
Right. I mean, that's a fundamental dilemma that characterizes most armed conflicts and most attempts at accountability for violations of the laws of war. Under the international laws of war, also known as international humanitarian law or the law of armed conflict, the primary responsibility for accountability for enforcement lies with the national authorities of the perpetrator. So in that case, to the extent that Russia has committed war crimes, the primary responsibility would lie with the Russian judicial system. It seems unlikely that Russia will hold its personnel accountable in any significant way at this point. After that, there are basically two potential avenues for accountability. One is in the criminal courts of other countries, third party countries, under some legal doctrines. It is possible to hold, to prosecute alleged war crimes that happened abroad. This happens occasionally in European countries occasionally do this. There have been cases of Syrian officials being prosecuted in European countries after they have, say, defected from the regime and found themselves in various European countries. Again, one of the issues with that, and this is a fundamental dilemma, again, is gaining custody of the accused. In the cases where we do see foreign prosecutions of war criminals, they're relatively rare, and they happen when perpetrators, like I said, tend to find themselves in other countries for various reasons, because they defected from a regime or they traveled there. So, gaining custody of the accused in that way will be difficult. The other option is prosecutions in international courts, like the Hague-based International Criminal Court or other types of international criminal tribunals that have been set up for particular conflicts. That court faces the same types of dilemmas. The International Criminal Court or courts like it don't have their own police forces, don't have their own military, so they have to rely on the cooperation and assistance of national authorities to go out and apprehend indicted suspects and to transfer them to the court. So it seems unlikely that, again, that the Russian government or to the extent that the Ukrainian government or Ukrainian forces are also potentially implicated in war crimes, it seems unlikely that they would voluntarily transfer their forces, member personnel, to the International Criminal Court. But you could imagine a few scenarios in which there could be some people who get detained. One would be people who have already been captured as prisoners of war and for whom there is evidence that they are implicated in war crimes. In those cases, say, Ukrainian forces capture Russian personnel and have evidence that they are implicated in war crimes, they could either prosecute them in their own domestic courts, or if the International Criminal Court indicts them, they could transfer them to the court. The other potential scenario that, is less likely, but, there's some glimmer of possibility, is a situation where, we don't know how the war is going to end, but a situation where, say, top Russian officials, like the president, are indicted by the International Criminal Court. As a condition for relieving sanctions, the broad sanctions that are on Russia right now, as a condition for that, Russia would need to, say, turn over indicted suspects to the court. That doesn't seem, likely, but, there is a kind of historical example of that in the Yugoslav wars with Slobodan Milosevic being turned over by his government in exchange for sanctions relief. It's a very different situation, but there is a kind of precedent for that.
Let's bring on a caller now. Nick is with us in Milwaukee. Nick, hello.
Yeah, hi. I just had a question about specifically the way that we have treaties and war crimes that we've seen the U.S. government and the U.S. military allege things like cluster bombs are war crimes, and humongous amounts of allegations that war crime, something's immoral, it's a war crime. But a lot of countries haven't signed treaties that make some of these munition types illegal, and we have a moral argument that the use of these munitions is a war crime, but really, it's not from a legal perspective, because there's no treaty actually making them banning them from combat. So I guess I just wanted your comment on that.
Nick, thanks for the call. Jessica, a particular type of munition, no treaties exist outlawing it. It seems morally wrong. How does that fit into how we measure war crimes?
Well, I mean, it is a war crime to cause disproportionate civilian harm. So even if perhaps cluster bombs or cluster munitions are not yet formally outlawed, the use of them in residential areas would still probably constitute a war crime because it violates a prohibition on causing disproportionate harm to civilians. And so I think there's still a way of thinking of them as war crimes. And I agree with the caller that I think these munitions should be banned under international law if they're not already banned, because they're essentially indiscriminate. Their very nature means that it's impossible to target them precisely against military targets. But as I said, the use of them can still be classified a war crime because of the way they cause disproportionate civilian harm in residential areas, which seems to be what we're seeing occurring in Ukraine.
Nick, thanks for that call. We're talking about war crimes with Jessica Wolfendale and Mark Berlin. They're both from Marquette University and have both written books on the subject. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Your concerns about what's going on with the Russian attack in Ukraine when it comes to potential war crimes, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Marquette University professors Jessica Wolfendale and Mark Berlin. They're with us today talking about war crimes, how they're prosecuted, what could happen with Vladimir Putin and other Russian leaders. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or your thoughts. 800-642-1234 is the number. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Madison. Bill, hi.
Hi. My concern is also the war crimes that are definitely going on right now. We got, 150,000 plus Ukrainians who had to get out and wanted to get out of there and crossed into Russia. I can almost guarantee they are locked up right now. Putin already says 15 years for anybody protesting the war. He's looking at anyone who's Ukrainian as an enemy of the state. My concern is, are we going to have Bosnia? Are we going to have World War II show up? Are we going to have other things going on that these people are being tortured? And, you know, Putin already, I mean, it's crazy. And is it going to be too late? They talk about the cost-benefit analysis. I can almost guarantee that these people are being locked up and tortured.
Bill, thanks for the call. Mark, there's what we're seeing on our screens, the hospitals being bombed, residential neighborhoods, as Jessica said. Bill's wondering what we're not seeing. What kind of concerns do you have, and how hard is it to uncover these things, especially in the context of war crimes?
Right. Well, so in terms of visibility and evidence, I mean, one of the remarkable things about this particular conflict is how well documented it is in real time. And that is important for, you know, being able to collect evidence in potential future prosecutions. One of, you know, I talked about the dilemma of apprehending indicted suspects. But one of the other fundamental dilemmas in prosecuting something like war crimes is collecting enough evidence to be able to substantiate responsibility for them, both at the bottom of the command chain and at the top. So the volume of kind of grassroots evidence, if you want to put it that way, in terms of cell phone video and photographs and things like that, represents a distinctive feature of this conflict and is going to be extremely important for potential prosecutions. And there's already a lot of efforts underway to collect that and preserve that kind of evidence. In terms of what might be happening in Russia to civilians that have fled there, I don't know. Under the law, civilians are supposed to be immune from not only physical attack, but also criminal prosecution to the extent that they haven't actually engaged in any war crimes. They are not supposed to be prosecuted or even detained, especially if they are fleeing the conflict zone for safety.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jessica, one thing we've already mentioned, it's gotten a lot of attention, the bombing of hospitals, a maternity hospital, for one. From a war crime perspective, does it matter if the hospital was targeted or if it was hit incidentally as part of military operations. Obviously, the tragedy is the same for the people hit. From a war crime perspective, does it matter if it was intentional?
Well, yes and no. So certainly intentionally targeting hospitals is a violation of laws of armed conflict. But again, so is what we might think of negligent targeting. So even if the hospital wasn't directly targeted, but there was little care taken to avoid harm, then that would also constitute excessive destruction of that's not justified by military necessity, which is itself a violation of the laws of armed conflict. So in either way, there's, you know, the firing of, you know, missiles and cluster munitions in areas where there is a hospital there, where it's known there's a hospital there, and where it's highly foreseeable the hospital will be hit. In some ways, at least the moral difference between intentional and unintentional, I think, disappears in that case. And legally, I think there's actually not that much of a difference either, right? That, you know, again, imposing disproportionate and excessive risk on civilians is also a war crime. So even if it's technically unintentional, I think it's safe to say that it still constitutes imposing this excessive risk.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm wondering about the concept of justice, what it means for the world and what it means for the United States. Recall in after World War II, America obtained Nazi scientists to work with in their missile program. They were never prosecuted. My Lai incident in Vietnam was covered up for quite a while. And finally, when I believe one person was prosecuted and ultimately had a very light sentence. And we've had drone strikes that have hit civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq. So regardless of the country, but particularly for America, what is justice?
Tom, thanks for the call. Mark, are we too quick to ignore war crimes for, I guess, reasons of political expediency?
Well, that is certainly a constant whenever there's an armed conflict and discussions about responsibility. You know, given the kind of practical challenges to enforcement and accountability, you know, often it is those who have more power, those who are the winners of a conflict, who have more say in who gets prosecuted and what kinds of crimes are considered. You know, famously at Nuremberg, the Allies made carve-outs in the jurisdiction or the kinds of crimes that the tribunal was going to focus on to make sure that they couldn't be accused of committing the same things that the Nazi leadership committed. So there's always compromises and cutting corners in the pursuit of justice. It's virtually impossible, or it is impossible, to completely separate politics from justice, even though there's this presumption that justice is supposed to be free from politics. You know, even with the best intentions, it's impossible to separate political considerations from the pursuit of justice.
Tom, thanks for the call. Hey. Oh, go ahead, Jessica.
Well, sorry, I just wanted to chime in there. Thanks, Tom. I think that's an important question. I mean, Mark's absolutely right, but I think Tom's also right to highlight that there's also, you know, hypocrisy on. That occurs when we don't like to think of the violence that we've inflicted. So, for example, the civilian deaths caused by drone strikes, we don't like to think of those as being war crimes, although in many ways they share similarities with what we're condemning in Ukraine, what's being condemned in Ukraine. So I think it's important that we are reflective about, well, if we are condemning these acts of violence in Ukraine, then we ought to look at acts of violence committed by, say, the US military, and if it's of the same kind, then it ought to be condemned in the same way. Now, that's in some ways idealistic, and I don't think that, you know, politically that rarely occurs, but I think it is important to bring that to mind if, for nothing else, and this is actually very important, to do justice to the victims of war crimes that have been committed by US military forces over the decades.
Thanks again for that call, Tom. And just our last minute or so, I wanted to hear from hopefully each of you with time, if you could be brief. Are you hoping, Jessica, that the world will take war crimes more seriously? There will be some sort of, I don't know, moral suasion that can prevent them from happening in the first place?
That's a very complex question. And it depends on what day it is and how optimistic I'm feeling. But part of me does feel a little pessimistic. I think it's great that there is so much outrage about what's happening in Ukraine, because what is happening there is an absolute atrocity. I wish, though, that that outrage did extend to victims of other conflicts, for example, the victims of Syria and other countries in which war crimes have occurred. So I would want, optimistically, I would like to think that the outrage we're seeing now will lead to a greater, more global recognition of the atrocity of war crimes.
And Mark, just in our last few moments, your thoughts on the future of war crime prosecutions?
Yeah. So, I mean, on any given day, you can find instances of war crimes, or, you know, there's conflicts that happen every year. It's interesting that this one has provoked the world to take such an interest in war crimes. And I think it's interesting to think about why that is. What's different about this conflict? Are there objective things that are different, or is it just people's perceptions about it because of, you know, who is involved, how the United States is involved? And so, if anything, I hope that this helps make people more aware of war crimes that happen other places and more concerned with them, and to see these as less extraordinary and more part of, you know, part of how they happen around the world on a regular basis.
We'll leave it there. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jessica, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Jessica Wolfendale, professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at Marquette University, and Mark Berlin, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. They've both written books about war crimes and international law. They were with us today for a look at war crimes and how the international community responds to them, especially in light of the latest news from Ukraine and the Russian invasion there.